Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Are you the parent or perhaps the grandparent of a girl? Now, bringing up any child can be a big challenge. Bringing up girls in today's world can be particularly frightening, though. The messages that girls are sent about their abilities, their bodies, their weight and their value can create an overwhelming sense that they're not good enough or don't measure up to society's expectations. And there are a raft of statistics that tell us that in lots of ways girls are struggling, and that's despite having much greater opportunities than ever before. Now, I wonder if you might remember a comment from a parent about your weight or maybe being told you shouldn't wear something because it made you look cheap. That's one that one of my grandmothers threw at me when maybe I wanted to wear a short skirt. Maybe you remember being made to kiss a relative that you didn't want to, just to be polite. Well, they're just a few examples of the messages that girls receive every day that can set them up for all sorts of issues later in life. Tonight, we've got some practical advice on what the girls of today need to help them navigate the world. Casey Edwards and Dr. Christopher Scanlon are a husband and wife team and the parent of two girls. Casey's a columnist and author. Christopher's a writer and academic. They decided to write a book about parenting girls after spending a lot of time thinking about how to ensure their two daughters would grow up to like themselves. They studied research from around the world. They talked to experts to put together a list of the characteristics that girls who like themselves have. And they've got advice on how you can help your daughter. Casey Edwards and Christopher Scanlon join me now. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Suzanne. Thanks for having us on.
Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. Now, Christopher, I'll start with you. You and Casey have two daughters, as I mentioned. Was there a moment that made you really stop and think about some of the challenges confronting girls today and what can be done about them and what you wanted to do?
Yeah, I think there was I wouldn't say at one moment, I'd say lots of moments you know, one was our kind of whole approach to parenting to begin with, which was very much, I would say, tiger parenting. You know, this idea that girls, there's so many opportunities out there and you want to open up all those opportunities for them and really, you know, really push them to do all these things that are available to them. And then you realise that they actually hate most of the things you're actually signing them up to, or, you know, they're kind of interested, but not really. And I think that was a bit of a wake-up call to us and thinking maybe we need to take a step back and sort of think about what they want. And the other ones are some of the ones you've just mentioned. You know, you just got to be a parent of a girl and take her outside the house, and the number of comments that she gets about her appearance, and that's the only thing people talk about. So, yeah, there was a whole lot of those moments, really.
So, Casey, let's start with some of the stats that paint a pretty gloomy picture of some of the problems facing girls today. Because on one hand, you know, this is a great moment for women. We've got more opportunities than we've ever had before. But the stats when it comes to some of the challenges facing girls are really troubling. Can you talk us through some of those?
Yeah, absolutely, Suzanne. And it is, it's a real surprise because, as you say, on one hand, you know, girls are smashing it in the classroom. There's all these wonderful role models for girls now in activism and sport and the arts. But it's like we've given these girls all these opportunities, and what they've received from us is the burden to excel and do them all to perfection. And that is really crushing a lot of our girls. You know, so one in five teenage girls meet the clinical criteria for depression. And anxiety in teenage girls, it's one in 14 suffer from anxiety. And as they get older, it gets to one in three. Body image, you know, our girls really are in crisis when it comes to body image. And it's happening younger and younger. We have heard stories from four separate parents during our research told the same story of 6 and 7 year old girls wanting to slice off the rolls on their stomach with scissors. You know, and these are young girls whose heads should be full of fairy dust and unicorns, and they're wanting to, you know, slice into their bodies. And another big concern is eating disorders. And I think that sadly this is misunderstood by a lot of people. They think that an eating disorder is, you know, just a diet that's you know, got out of hand. But our daughters, so now have a greater chance of dying from an eating disorder than they do from being abducted by a stranger on the street. And that's really chilling to us because we thought about how much time we have spent worrying and taking precautions to reduce the risk of stranger danger compared with how much time we hadn't really thought about reducing the risk of eating disorders.
All really chilling statistics that you point out there, Casey. Now, Christopher, what's your view on how comfortable most dads feel dealing with some of the issues that are likely to affect their daughters?
I would say not very. I think that fathers are often, well, first of all, I don't think there's a lot of really positive, role models of fathers in our society. We have, you know, Homer Simpson, we have American Dad, and, you know, it's the sort of the doofus dad who's sort of the butt of the jokes and kind of a bit useless at everything, who might have a heart of gold, but, you know, mostly gets things wrong. So I don't think we've got great role models out there. I think Bluey is, you know, gives us probably the best version of a father today, so that maybe that's changing. But I think from a very young age, boys don't get that a great vision of fatherhood. And then when you take it forward into parenting girls in particular, I think often fathers kind of, particularly as they get older, often don't really know what to do and what their role is. And I think, you know, as their daughter changes and attitudes, change, fathers are often a bit cast adrift. I don't think there's as many resources out there for fathers either. I think despite all the strides that have been made in the workplace with parental leave and those sorts of things, I still think that there's still a big cultural blocker there for a lot of dads to actually exercise and take up some of those rights. So that the institutional policies might be in place and all the rest of it, but it's more how often men police each other and, you know, that their fathering role.
I wonder too whether there's a sense, particularly maybe as daughters get older, that that's mum's job to deal with. You know, when there are tricky conversations, go talk to your mother about that.
I think that's the case. I think sort of, if something like, you know, talking about periods, well, as a man, you have no real experience. You've got, you can read about it in books, but you have no understanding really. But I think it's very important to be, you know, part of those conversations and to be someone that she can come to and talk openly about, you know, whether it's periods, changes to her body or whatever, that she still is able to, you know, feel that comfortable having those conversations and confide in you.
Now, Casey, the book is called Raising Girls Who Like Themselves. Why was that the idea that you honed in on, the idea that you thought could really encompass many of the issues that girls are facing?
So there's two reasons for that. And the first one is when we did our own research to work out how to be the best parents we could possibly be. Because when our first daughter was born, we were absolutely clueless and were shocked that we were given such an incredible responsibility to raise a person when we were so unprepared. So we did a lot of research into how to be really good parents. And everything that we've read and all the experts that we spoke to, it all led back to the same thing, that absolutely everything that we hope and dream for our girls starts from raising girls who like themselves. And as we all know, when we have a goal and when we can define it and be specific about it, we have a lot greater chance of achieving it. So there's that reason. But the second reason is actually more personal. And for me, I wanted my girls to grow up liking themselves more than I grew up liking myself. And I just felt that was the greatest gift that I could give them.
Casey, just tell us a bit more about your own sense of how much you did or didn't like yourself when you were a teenager, if you're happy to do that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I had a reasonably normal childhood, but I mean, one of the one of the big things for me was body image, and I'm not Robinson Crusoe on this. You know, our women of our generation, girls, you know, weight and beauty was a constant conversation. In my family, the women, you know, policed each other. I was put on the scales and talked about, you know, if I gained weight, you know, I wouldn't find a husband. And my mom to this day still thinks that it is the greatest compliment she can give someone to say, you've lost weight, you look lovely. So this constant conversation about weight and beauty was surrounded me growing up and really played a really big role in me defining my identity and my self-worth. And what else is going on here too, and even, which is even a greater problem for our girls, is that the standard of beauty is perpetually out of reach. You know, nobody is beautiful enough in today's society. And so when you grow up thinking that beauty is the most important thing a woman can have and be, and that you, then you can't reach that standard, then obviously you're crippled by this sense of failure. So the body image was a really big problem. And for me also just perfectionism, just terrified of making a mistake. I felt like I needed to be perfect and that I would be unlovable if I wasn't a good girl. And that's something we really address in the book, that there's a lot of pressure on girls to think that if they have to be perpetually nice and sweet and obliging, and it's just too much to expect of anyone not to have the whole range of human emotions. And that we really need to teach our girls to express those emotions in productive ways rather than be ashamed of them. Because I think I'm not the only one who knows that when you have to be nice all the time, it kind of leaks out of you in counterproductive ways.
Our guests tonight on Nightlife are Casey Edwards and Christopher Scanlon. They're a husband and wife team. They're parents of two girls. They're the authors of a book called Girls Who Like Themselves. Christopher, just to get a different perspective, I mean, I'm sure you and Casey have talked a lot about this, but when you listen to her talking about her feelings about herself and those attainments to beauty that I think most young women, it's pushed in your faces. As a man, did you find any of that seeped through to you, the pressure for you to be attractive?
Oh yeah, and look, you know, I remember distinctly in the 1990s, late 80s, 1990s, when the Calvin Klein model suddenly started appearing on bus shelters, and suddenly male beauty was, you know, highly desirable commodity, and I remember, you know, sort of feeling that's kind of what a man looks like, you know, so. I think that, but I think that, you know, that men have been living with this for a lot shorter time. And I think, you know, my generation was the first to really encounter that. I think it's slightly different for gay men. I think they'd been living for a long time, but straight men, I think that's when it really hit in the late 80s, early 1990s. And I had an eating disorder when I was in grade 11 and 12. Which was partly about the pressure of school. I had an eating disorder, I had an anorexia.
Gosh, I'm sorry to hear that, Christopher. All right, Casey, you've put together a list of seven characteristics of a girl who likes herself. I want you to just run through those with me and then we might pick apart some of them individually. What are they?
Sure. Okay, so these are the seven qualities that a girl who likes herself must have. And so in our book, we talk about how to instill them and also how to protect our girls from today's society that's going to try and corrode them. So the first one is a power perspective, and that is the idea of teaching our girls to think in a way that works for them rather than against them. So feeling like they actually are in control of the world around them, they can influence what happens, and that their opinion about themselves matters more than anyone else's. So rather than deferring to the authority of other people or peer pressure or chance events, for example. So that's power perspective. The second one is body confidence, and we've touched on that a little bit. And we feel that a lot of the advice that parents get to develop their daughter's body confidence is actually part of the problem rather than part of the solution. Because we think that body confidence is strutting around in your bikinis or fitspiration. But for us, body confidence is about caring more about what your body does than how it appears. And it's about not letting thoughts about your body ruin your day and define your identity. And so building up your self-worth and identity on things other than other people's perceptions of your beauty. The next one is body ownership. And this one's quite controversial, but we think is vitally important. We are very good at telling girls that they own their body and no means no, for example. But there's all these little micro ways that we actually convey to girls that the opposite is true, that they don't get to decide how they look. They don't get to decide if they do or don't want to give affection, for example. So we have a rule about body ownership in our family, and it is this, that if it's not permanent and it's not harmful, our girl gets to decide, no matter how much we would wish otherwise or how uncomfortable other people might be.
Yeah, and I want to come back and pick some of this apart because you've really had some interesting hurdles you've had to jump mentally while thinking this one through.
That's right, that's right. And the next one is mastery and independence. And this is looking at the self-esteem movement that we had growing up, which was, and how that got things wrong, that you are awesome parenting doesn't actually give self-esteem. Real self-esteem comes from girls and boys feeling like they can actually do things for themselves. And the road to mastery is paved with struggle. So this is about allowing our kids to struggle, making it normal and support them to fail and helping them to get back up and try again. The next one is calm. Girls who like themselves are not tired. I mean, anyone who's chronically tired is not their best selves. So they're not tired and they're not overscheduled. And this is about finding the courage as parents to push back against this pressure to constantly overschedule our kids so that they're constantly having adult-led activities that are measured rather than having downtime to play. The next one is strong relationships. So there is a misassumption that that relationship skills just develop naturally and we don't have to teach them. But we would suggest that if you take a look around at maybe some of your colleagues or extended family, that maybe you'd think that not everyone learnt those skills in the playground. And so anyone with a daughter, a tween daughter, knows that friendship is so important to a girl. And so this is about getting ahead of the game and teaching our girls how to deal with conflict, how to choose good friends and developing their relationship skills. And the last one is about authenticity. And we say that a girl who likes herself is herself. And this is about, rather than trying to sculpt our child into this vision, preconceived vision that we have of them, it's about allowing them to bloom in their own time and in their own way, and in supporting them to be the best version of themselves that they were born to be.
All right, well, now we've listed them out, let's go back and really delve into, because there are a couple of them that are particularly interesting. And I think perhaps we might go to the one about a girl who likes herself owns a body. And it's really tricky. I mean, most girls are told that their bodies aren't actually theirs to do with as they wish. I mean, that's the subtle message we get from our parents every time we talk. You can't wear that. You can't get your ears pierced. No, that mascara makes you look terrible. So it's really confusing. Now, you had to confront this a couple of years ago because your daughters wanted a makeup kit for Christmas. Tell me what you thought when they went, "Mom, Dad, can we have a makeup kit for Christmas?"
Well, so my first thought was, no, of course not. You're too young. Like, this just popped into my head because that's what my mother would have said. And that's what we say. You know, I was scrolling through my, you know, parent rule book about what age was appropriate for a girl to wear makeup. And I was pretty sure that, you know, 4 and 9 was not it. But anyway, this was the age of my girls when they wanted their makeup kits. But then I thought, oh, and I was also worried that particularly my older daughter would go to school and talk about the makeup and she'd set off this makeup trend and all these other parents would be going, "Oh, Casey, what has she done to us?" And then I thought, what's my problem here? My problem is my feeling about how people are going to react to my girls. So makeup, you know, it's face paint to girls, you know. There was nothing sexual about it. They weren't growing up too fast. They weren't trying to hide their flaws. They wanted to wear makeup because mummy wears makeup. And that was a real wake-up call to me about how my default response was to actually deny body autonomy to my girls. And so in the end, we bought the makeup kits and we said, you know, it's your body, your face. You can do what you like with it. Have fun.
And what happened?
Well, you know, Ivy, our youngest, smeared lipstick on her eyebrows. And
we actually went to a wedding on the weekend and they both got the makeup out and they were, you know, again, smeared with...
Yeah, and look, they looked absolutely ridiculous. And would I have preferred that they didn't? Yes, I would. But it's not my decision. And it's far more important for my girls to know that they own their bodies and their opinion about their appearance matters more than anyone's, including mine. That lesson is way more important than my temporary discomfort at the wedding because of the way my girls' faces looked.
And what happened with the other parents, Casey? Did they spark a trend at school?
We certainly did for earrings because, again, we had – so makeup, that was not so bad, but earrings because my daughter asked for them, again, when she was quite young. And, again, I had to challenge myself. But by that stage, we'd already had our parenting rule in place and it was like, well, it's not permanent because she can take them out and it's not harmful, so we have to say yes. And that did spark a couple of interesting conversations with my friends. But once I explained my reasoning that in years to come, my voice is going to be replaced by other people's voices. It's going to be the beauty industry. It's going to be friends and frenemies. It's going to be boyfriends. And I need my girls to know that they get to decide what happens to their body. So when it's not my voice, they're in a position and to make a good choice to enforce their own boundaries and own decisions. And interestingly, most of those girls whose parents initially objected then ended up getting their ears pierced.
My guests on Nightlife are Casey Edwards and Christopher Scanlon, who are the authors of a book called Girls Who Like Themselves. Now, Christopher, I mean, we are terrible. And I mean, I have to admit, I probably would have balked if I had a daughter who'd done that, who'd asked me for makeup. Now, just yesterday, I remember being somewhere and seeing what looked like a five-year-old girl wearing lipstick. And instead of thinking, oh, well, how great that she's, you know, enjoying the face paint for five-year-olds, immediately I was like, why is her mother letting her wear lipstick? I mean, it's a really gut reaction. But Christopher, we're terrible, aren't we? We judge parents who let their girls wear makeup or wear clothing that's too skimpy. Many of us think we're actually railing against girls becoming sexualized too young, but you actually think we need to turn that whole argument around.
Yeah, I think we do. And I think we've got to really sort of, you know, trust our girls in this regard and really sort of, is it something we're projecting onto our girls? Because when you look at little girls, particularly with something like makeup, it's play, you know, they're doing it because they see mum or older women do this. So this is kind of just, you know, part of the play acting. We don't have a problem when they play act all sorts of other parts of adult life. And, you know, we just sort of think that's innocent. But I think this is just another one. And we project it, we make it into something far greater than it is. And in the process, what we're doing is we are sending those messages that you don't really own your body. We kind of pretend you do, but when you actually try and exercise some of that power, that agency, we kind of then quickly grab it off you and say, no, there's limits to this. And I think that's the really, it's that we might have nuanced reasons for doing that, but I don't think that's the message that's sent because there's very little, you know, capacity there for nuance.
And this whole idea too, isn't it? I mean, no one's, if these girls are being sexualized, it's the adults who are doing it, not the children in their choice of clothing. When my husband tells a story about taking his daughter when she was maybe six to the swimming pool, and she had never worn, you know, she'd always been wearing kind of little shorts, but not a top. And, you know, he got roundly told off for not having her in a top because, look, who might be watching and looking at her? And it ended up, I think, turning into a really humiliating scene and they ended up leaving the pool because, you know, that's how she wanted to be at the swimming pool, but she wasn't allowed to because of what other people might think or how they might view her.
And I think that's the message that, you know, the child takes away from that, the girl takes away from that. That's what they're going to remember from that kind of situation. So that you got to think, well, do you say anything or do you just keep quiet and take a reflective moment and say, is this more about me? Is it kind of, am I concerned? about something, about how I'm feeling, rather than how the girl's feeling.
Now, Casey, the issue of being forced to kiss relatives is a bit of a tricky one. There's a lot of backlash when it's suggested that no child should be forced to pucker up to great Aunt Agnes unless they really want to. Why is this such a tricky one? And why do you think we really need to look at whether it's right to force kids to kiss relatives or other people they come into contact with?
Yeah, look, it really worries me and upsets me that this is so controversial. I really think that in 2021, a girl deciding who she wants to kiss should not be controversial, but it is. I mean, I have been called the kissing police on the front page of the Daily Mail in the UK. So it really has, my view on this has gone viral. You know, it's been picked up in America as well. And my argument is that if we want our girls to exercise their own judgment and enforce their own boundaries when they're older, for example, when they are asked to send nudes to a boy, or when a sleazy boss slides his hand up a girl's skirt, or when a boyfriend is pressuring a girl to do something she doesn't want to do. If we want our girls to be able to enforce their boundaries, they need to practice that. And when we tell our girls that they have to do something with their bodies to make someone else comfortable, we are teaching them the opposite. Now, we are not saying that kids shouldn't show affection to grandparents. Our girls are very affectionate to the important adults in their life, and we think that's lovely. The important issue here is choice. So the child should be able to choose whether or not they want to show affection, and they should have the backing of their parents, of us, even if it makes us feel uncomfortable.
Again, I mean, I'm thinking back to my own childhood. I remember some man following me along the road. I must have been about seven. And, you know, he came up to me and he said, you give me a hug. And I think I thought, well, I've got to. You know, it's rude not to. I don't want to upset him.
Suzanne, that happened to me 2 days ago. I couldn't believe it. You know, I have been not hugging all of COVID. I've been very strict with women who've wanted to hug me, and then a man in authority tried to hug me and I allowed it. And I thought, wow, it's so hard for me as a 44-year-old woman to enforce my boundaries. How on earth do we expect girls to do that when they have never had an opportunity to practice?
All right, so your message is from the beginning, enforce that idea. You can embrace, you can kiss who you want to, don't be forced into it because it's a matter of being polite.
That's right. And there are other ways that kids can be polite. You know, they can give a high five. They can do a fist bump. So we're not saying that kids should not engage with other people or be rude. It's just they shouldn't be forced to show affection if they don't want to.
Now, I might put this to you, Christopher. Someone that has SMS'd in says, look, I've got three girls. I'm finding this conversation very interesting. Can you discuss social media a bit more? I agree regarding girls enforcing their own boundaries and own decisions, but when I see the social media images some 14-year-old girls are posting, I think they need adults talking them through what's appropriate to put on social media at such a young age. Christopher, maybe do you want to take that one up?
Well, I think that that's a tricky one because, and I know why parents struggle with this, because so much of social life is now on social media. So if your child isn't on it, then, you know, they really are cut out of friendship groups and all sorts of things there. So our first rule on with social media is, first of all, go with the age guidelines. So, you know, if it's Instagram or Facebook and it's 13 years old, then, you know, you stick with that. But then it's also, you know, with a 14-year-old girl, then, you know, she meets that and then there's concern about what they're actually doing. I think we as parents also have a role to get in there and to be actively, you know, part of that online world and not sort of saying, oh, no, that's kind of, you know, kid stuff. We don't understand that. We're of a different generation. I think it's really important for us to get in there as well and kind of be part of that conversation and, you know, talking to our girls about the kinds of things they're posting, what messages they're sending, and particularly when they are a bit older, to then kind of, you know, have that conversation. And do you know how that, what you're actually saying by that as well? And they may be aware of that and they may not, but to really sort of, you know, to pick apart some of those messages that they are potentially putting out there in the world. So I think that's an important one to have that conversation. But I think with social media and with all of these online platforms, we really need to start that conversation much earlier too. So while then, when they're not on those platforms, to kind of make kids aware in an age-appropriate way of some of the dangers that they might be on that platform. So, for example, our girls are on Roblox, which is a little platform where they play games. So we've locked that down and put some security on it. It's highly social in the sense that all their friends are on it and they chat. We do things like we take the chat outside of that environment, so they're on a separate platform when they're chatting with their friends, so only their friends can get to it. But then also locking it down to the games that are curated within that world as well, that platform. So that's another thing. But also, I've got an account, so I go in there with the girls and play on those environments. Now that can, you know, to me, that is just like accompanying girls to, you know, the shopping center. And I think that's kind of how we need to start thinking about a lot of these digital platforms, that these are extensions of their social life. Increasingly, when we were as kids, might have gone to the local shopping center. Now they're going on to these platforms to play, and we need to be part of that conversation as well, and part of that world. So as they get older, that gets a little bit trickier, but, you know, so, but you, I think you really sort of need to, again, you know, talk to your girls about those platforms.
I also think that when we have discomfort at what girls are posting on social media, we need to have a difficult conversation with ourselves about why we're uncomfortable. And look, when I see a teenage girl pouting at the lens in a selfie, I cringe inside and I hate looking at it, and I'm just dreading the day that my girls do it. But then I have to ask myself, why? Why am I so uncomfortable at this? And it's because we have been taught that, you know, girls who do that are asking for it. Now, that's not true. You know, on an intellectual level, we know that, you know, we're beyond victim blaming now, right? A girl is not asking for anything, no matter how she pouts her lips, right? So we need to really reflect on our own unconscious bias about why we're so uncomfortable when we see these pictures.
Now, Casey, I do want to delve into the issue of weight. I mean, this really relates back to a girl who liking herself, having body confidence. I mean, this is a huge one. There'd hardly be a woman in Australia who doesn't feel that her body doesn't measure up to all of those Instagram influencers, the lingerie ads. Now, you reckon many of our hang-ups about weight probably come from the role modelling our own mothers did for us. So give me some examples of stories you've heard about what girls saw and heard their own mothers, you know, do and say. Particularly when it comes to dieting.
Yeah, so first of all, I just want to say this is a very complex issue, and it's not, I don't want to just blame mothers here, right? But I also think that, you know, we are our kids' first teachers, and girls are not born hating their bodies. So there are lots of influences in this world that are going to encourage our girls to hate their bodies. As I see my role as a mother is to try and do everything I can to prevent that or reduce it, okay? So some of the stories that we hear is constant conversations about dieting and, you know, mum doesn't like her weight, and everyone in the family knows that, including the kids. So, for example, my body image is not great. It's better than it was, but it's not great. But my girls don't know that. They wouldn't ever see me on the scales. They won't ever hear me talk about negatively about my body. You know, I don't diet. I haven't dieted for a long time. But if I were to, I wouldn't discuss that with my girls, because I think it is really too much to ask a lot of women to suddenly like their bodies, you know. But the thing is, if we can't drop the baggage, we can choose not to unpack it in front of our kids, because that's how our girls learn to be women, by watching us. And it's the thing that we've noticed is it's not just the conversations that we have, it's the conversations that friends and family have. And grandparents in particular are incredibly influential in developing girls' body images, because grandparents have this really special role in kids' lives. And also they're, you know, the mother or the mother-in-law or father-in-law. So it's a complicated relationship. So if grandma is constantly talking about her own weight, mum's weight, the weight of the child, then that will affect the way the girl sees herself. But the flip side of that, if grandparents are focused on what your girl can do and they have a really special time with grandma or grandpa that has nothing to do with how they look, it can be fun things that they do together, then that can be a real protective factor for a girl's confidence as well.
Yeah, Christopher, what are your practical suggestions then as about how we talk to about weight with our daughters, if we do at all? Because, I mean, you've heard stories of parents feeling like, well, I have to tell my daughter she's overweight because if I don't tell her, well, how's she going to know and how's she going to fix it? I mean, that's, you know, tell me about the conversations you've had with other fathers along those lines.
I think the, well, we've had conversations, well, we've heard, and we've heard of conversations, parents saying that, you know, they want to have that conversation. They need to have that conversation with their daughter. And our advice is very, very simple. Don't ever have that conversation. And this is backed up by Dr. Rick Korsman, who's a doctor who specializes in really, I guess, people recovering from, you know, the diet industry. He says, you know, and this is almost a quote, nothing good can come of that conversation. And I think parents really have to remember, well, there's a couple of things. The images you see out there are completely unrealistic, okay? They bear no relationship to the bodies that you see around you and that throughout human history have existed. They don't actually, most of the ones in social media advertised in the beauty industry, they exist for a couple of days. And then, you know, as people, the models or whatever, get into a particular condition and then they kind of go off from that. So it's just not realistic at all. And it's not healthy, so it's not sustainable. The other thing I think we've got to remember is that children's bodies are growing and they are going to change. Sometimes they're going to be heavier, sometimes they're going to be less heavy. And it's just your job as a parent, I think, is to simply make sure your child, your daughter is, you know, getting, doing a fun activity that may be exercise, it may be just playing, it might be kind of, you know, something that she actually likes doing rather than regards as a punishment. And your other thing is to just provide a range of foods, and they can be what we would call sometimes foods and everyday foods. And we're quite deliberate in that, moving away from good and bad foods, you know, clean eating, which would suggest that there's dirty foods out there. So that's our job as parents. And I think so I would say that some of the, you know, take some of the pressure off. If you are feeling that pressure, oh, I've got to have this conversation, I get bombarded with all these messages about childhood obesity and the epidemic and all the rest of it. We've had that narrative for so long and it doesn't seem to be working. You know, the dietitians and the public health authorities tell us it's getting worse and worse. So the strategy isn't working. So I would go with the advice, don't have that conversation. It is likely to be far more damaging. And the most important thing you can give to your daughter is, you know, be that safe place, that unconditional love and support for her.
On the SMS, someone says, I remember going into a boutique when I was 15 with a friend. The lady came over, told me when I started looking that there'd be nothing in the store that would fit me. It's the kind of thing that's going to send your day on a downward spiral, isn't it? Now, Casey, I mean, just thinking about stories my friends have told me, nearly everyone has a story about a parent making a comment about their body that has absolutely stuck with them over the years. I mean, I remember my own dad saying when I was about 12, geez, you're getting a really big thighs and bottom there, you know, and other parents say, oh, would you feel happier if you lost a little bit of weight? I suppose parents think they're being quite helpful, but those comments get right inside, don't they?
That's right. So parents have been told really that if they make sure their daughter's thin and they police her appetite until she's old enough to police it herself, then she'll be thin and therefore she'll like herself. But the whole idea is just crazy. How are you going to like something you've been taught to mistrust and be insecure about? through our research, we found a couple of people who really did not have any body image problems at all. So there are a few unicorns in the world. And what these people had in common is parents that did not discuss how their body looked. And I just think that's so important. You know, parents, we get in first, you know. Of course, there are going to be all these influences outside of our home. But if we can lay that foundation first, then, you know, that's got to be better than nothing. So our girls know that we think they're beautiful, but they also know that we do not care how they look. You know, on all the thing about all the things that we love and value about them, how their appearance and how they look is not even on the list.
Now, let's look at some of the other aspects of raising a girl who likes herself. My guests on Nightlife tonight are Casey Edwards and Christopher Scanlon. Now, Casey, a girl who likes herself is independent and masterful. Now, this is encouraging your daughters to be the very opposite of the damsel in distress, isn't it? And you learn more or less the hard way with your first child, because you kind of encouraged her to be the damsel in distress in the playground, didn't you?
We did, absolutely. We were those, you know, classic first-time overprotective, overattentive parents. And we hovered around Violet trying to make her life as easy as possible. So we'd get to the playground and we'd help her climb up the frame or lift her up onto the slide. And she became so dependent on us. She would stand at the bottom of playground equipment and lift her hands up and just look at us. And it was shocking to us about how quickly we had instilled helplessness in her. And then when our second daughter, Ivy, came along, two things had changed. One, we weren't first-time parents anymore, so we were too busy to hover the way we did the first time. But we'd also begun the process of researching for this book and started to understand the importance of mastery. So we didn't help Ivy on playground equipment. We allowed her to get frustrated. We talked to her about strategies at how she might climb the climbing frame differently. And I remember the first time she did it at this park, she had tried and tried and tried, and then she finally did it and she stood up on the climbing frame, and this look of pride and achievement on her face was priceless. And what struck me was that I could not have given that to her. You can't give it that sense of pride and self-worth through presence. You can't do it through words of encouragement. You can only achieve that through mastery. And that we had actually denied Violet, our oldest daughter, all these years of opportunities of mastery because we were helping her too much.
Right. So it's really interesting. It does certainly turn a lot on its head. I mean, I know too, when I see my son go up a level in swimming, he gets out of the pool so goddamn proud of himself. And I think, it's the same thing. And he actually says to me, I'm really proud of myself. I worked really hard. I think this is fantastic, because he's also learning the lesson that if he just keeps trying, he'll get there without having to rely on anyone else.
That's right. There's so much pressure on parents to create this perfect childhood. And part of that seems to be, you know, removing the struggle from our kids' life. But one of the things we write about in the book is riding a bike for the first time. You know, it's such a profound moment in a person's life. And one of the reasons for that is that a child has to do it by themselves. You cannot ride your child's bike for them, and they can only achieve that through struggle. They tried, they failed, they fell off, they got back on, and then finally they did it themselves. And that is one of the reasons it is such a precious memory for people.
All right, let's talk, Christopher, about overscheduling. This fits into a girl who likes herself being calm. And now, when you say calm, you really mean time to not be under pressure, to be achieving at all these things that your parents have signed you up for. Why is it important to leave that time? I'm sure a lot of parents will think, well, look, I'll give them a chance to try this and a chance to try that, and maybe they'll find the thing they're really passionate about. And if I expose them to everything, many more opportunities later on. What's wrong with that way of thinking?
I think because both your child and you will be completely exhausted by that. And I think one of the other things of this is that it often doesn't allow any time for play, and play in the pure sense. Often we have play activities, but when you look, you don't have to peer too far beneath the surface to find out they're actually a structured learning activity with a thin veneer of play on top. And I think that's one of the things that often these, you know, all these opportunities miss. So children actually don't have that completely unstructured time of child-led and child-chosen activities where they're just, you know, doing something because for the pure enjoyment of it. It's not looking at an outcome. There's no metric around it. They're just doing it because they love doing it and they get lost in it. So it's really having that downtime. And a big part of that is, you know, so I think there's another one where, again, parents can take a step back and you can, you know, you don't have to feel guilty for filling up for your child's whole week with these, you know, enriching activities. You can stop being the Uber driver, you know, ferrying your child from one activity to another. And part of this, we also would say, you know, there's a lot of talk about screen time at the moment. People, you know, we know of people who limit their child's screen time to no more than 30 minutes a day. And they think they're doing, you know, they're told by the public health people, by including the World Health Organization, that this is the thing to do. The evidence for that is hopelessly poor. It is appallingly poor. And in fact, there has been research done by in the UK, which shows that actually when you look at well-being and, you know, time on screens, it's actually no worse than being than having to go to school for glasses for the first time. So you'll experience a similar drop in well-being from wearing glasses to school for the first time as you will with being on screens. And that's something which we found through our research, that, you know, this just does not add up. So if kids want to spend time on screens, you know, playing a game, often engaging with other kids, just kind of that downtime, that's actually perfectly fine. And in fact, the UK paediatric psychologists, they say that the evidence is so poor on this, they do not recommend any minimum screen time. Their advice is, if your child is doing everything that they need to do, hitting all those basic milestones, and you're not worried about their screen time, then don't worry about it.
Well, I might end up by reading a few of the SMSs that have come into us. You know, someone says, my mother never lied to me about how she felt about her body. She didn't talk about it at all. She didn't talk about it all the time either. She was very supportive of our choices and our right to make them. It's the media that rams poor self-esteem and body image. Much better to talk openly and honestly about these issues, and then we can make informed decisions. Someone else saying, look, great discussion about raising daughters. Like to add, I think we need to encourage our daughters to ask questions about stereotypes regarding the sexes. Our girls should ask, why do boys not wear makeup? Why don't they pose on selfies like girls? You know, why do women wear makeup and not men? Let them learn through critical analyses about gender roles, and then maybe they don't have to participate. So, yeah, a couple of interesting SMSs there. Thank you for your book. It's really interesting. I have to say I've found, I've got two boys, but reading it in the last week, I've been able to apply a couple of things. I've been talking to one of my children who tends to be a little bit more negative than the other, and trying to encourage him to see that the good in his day, he had some role in, and he is powerful and can make good things happen. And that's actually been quite successful a number of times. So I must thank you for the tip.
Oh, we're so pleased to hear that, Suzanne. That's great.
That's fantastic,
Suzanne. Oh, thanks so much for being my guest on Nightlife tonight.
Our pleasure. Thank you for having us.
That's Casey Edwards and Dr. Christopher Scanlon, a married couple. They are the parents of two girls and they are the authors of a new book called Raising Girls Who Like Themselves.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.